Welcome to the Enduring Curiosity Podcast. I am your host, Greg Outer. Join us as we seek solutions to the challenges facing our world today. Through curiosity, we can forge a resilient future for all life on this planet. This week, I'm thrilled to welcome Charleston Waterkeeper's Executive Director, Andrew Wunderly, to the show. Andrew is an avid swimmer, surfer, and advocate for Charleston's waterways. He earned his JD cum laude from the Charleston School of Law and Masters of Science and Environmental Policy at the College of Charleston. Andrew serves as the eyes, ears, and voice of his local waterways. He is the Charleston Waterkeeper. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Greg. Good to be here with you.
So first things first, what is a waterkeeper?
You know, the notion of a waterkeeper, I think, is really unique in that, you know, it's a, I think, you know, sort of technically, right, it's a local identifiable person that stands up and speaks for and on behalf of their local waterways. But, I think more than that, you know, the idea of a waterkeeper for me goes to this notion of the public trust. And the notion of the public trust is something that goes way back, like to the Magna Carta, to the Institutes of Justinian, and comes to us through English common law and you know, a long kind of boring legal discussion there. But long story short is, you know, it's this notion that some things are too valuable to be privately owned, and therefore they're considered to be part of the public trust. And so, you know, that's things like water in our creeks and rivers, the air that we breathe, the fish that swim in the sea, that these things are so valuable that they belong to all of us. And so the idea of a waterkeeper is somebody that defends all that and protects it and works to make sure that it is managed and wisely used for the next generation of folks that are going to come along and inhabit our community.
So that idea of stewardship seems to be at the heart of a lot of the work that you do. One of the things that I love that's on your website is the idea that stewardship can teach conservation through action. Now, would you mind telling us what that means?
Well, this one's pretty personal to me. I always had a hard time sitting still in school. And so I've found over, you know, I've come to realize over the course of my life that I personally am a lot better at learning and experiencing things by doing them rather than by, you know, listening and reading in books. And, you know, I read a lot of books and I listen a lot, but, you know, you really learn through experience. And so, you know, the idea of what we do, you know, through our volunteer corps, through a lot of our water quality testing, through, you know, putting people out into the marsh, through working with DNR to build oyster reef and recycle oyster shell, the idea, all that is to take people out there, show them what this resource is, let them get dirty, let them get wet, you know, let them get a little scratched up from oyster shells and you know, sweaty and all of that, and have them experience these environments firsthand. The notion, I think, that, you know, you protect what you know, you protect what you love is really rings true for us. And so, you know, from that is where stewardship flows, right? You know, if you don't have a connection, if you don't understand what a tidal creek is, if you don't understand what it's like to try to muck through the pluff mud, if you don't understand how an oyster works, right, all of it's just abstract. It's just a pretty view. But when you get down in there and you see and experience these places firsthand, that's where stewardship grows from. And so we teach that idea of like, hey, look, this is a special resource. You've got to get out here. You've got to experience it. And once you experience it, you're going to want to take care of it because of how special it is. And so the more people we can pump through that work, the better, you know, rather than going into classrooms or speaking to groups. And we do that work quite a bit. You know, we've just found it's you know, the light, you can see it. It's cliche and it's a little cheesy, but you know, you can see the light bulb go off for folks. They come and do a cleanup with us, and everything they pull out is plastic, single-use plastic, bags, bottle caps, bottles, you know, styrofoam, that sort of thing. And the light bulb goes off and they go, oh my gosh, we got a problem. We got to do something about this. And so, you know, that's where that stewardship comes from, right? You know, we're not just telling people about the problems. We're showing them and then providing them a pathway to get active and do something about it. And, you know, that in that way, I mean, we're really kind of connecting them to the levers of power that sort of make, you know, that weigh in on these issues. And so, you know, I think it's probably one of the more important things that we do. And, you know, oh, it's great to build oyster reef too. It's great to do a cleanup. I mean, you make an impact just on the surface of that. But, you know, really that work is about turning people into advocates and stewards for their waterways. We sneak it up on them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That immersive education is so key. And I think a lot of what you were just talking about will ring true to the folks all around the world who tune into this show. We are partnered with an organization called the Sustainable Ocean Alliance that is a connection to young people from all around the world. And they seem to be dealing with a lot of those same issues. So just to help them better understand what Charleston Waterkeeper is working with, what kind of ecosystems are part of this watershed?
Right. We're a very special type of waterway here. We're an estuary, right? So, you know, the very specific technical scientific definition of an estuary is, and I'm kind of joking here, but it's where fresh and salt water meet in an enclosed area, right? So, you know, the Charleston Harbor, you know, and the rivers that come off of that are estuary, right? And so you've got fresh water coming from swamps and from wetlands inland, and you've got salt water brought in by the tides, and that kind of mixes in the harbor. And so we have four main river systems here. We have the Wando River, the Cooper River, we have the Ashley River, and we have the Stono River. Those are the four primary big river systems. I think of those, the Ashley River is probably the most intact hydrologically, the Ashley and the Stono. And the Wando is pretty good too. The Cooper River is almost totally engineered, and so is the Charleston Harbor. A long time ago, they took the Santee River. Well, they dammed up the headwaters, the freshwater wetland headwaters of the Cooper River, and then diverted parts of the Congaree River into there, and then from there diverted some back into the Santee River. It's a whole kind of weird sort of plumbing situation up there. And so everything from the depth of the Charleston Harbor to the amount of flow that comes down the Cooper River to the amount of silt to the level of dissolved oxygen in that harbor system through the Cooper River is all controlled by an agreement, right? By contract, right? It's not, you know, a lot of people think it's, oh, we've this, you know, pristine natural system here. It's, you know, almost totally engineered, you know, especially when we're talking about the Cooper and the Wando. So, you know, almost everything we deal with has been touched by the hand of human. I mean, from the times of, you know, from the enslaved peoples and rice culture and, you know, to phosphate mining and, you know, on through industrialization and then on through like navigational channels and all that. So we have we're lucky in the sense that we have a pretty intact estuary, but it is not at all pristine or untouched. And so, you know, it's really up to us to make sure that we're taking care of that for the future.
So what kind of flora and fauna call this system home?
Oh, wow. This is always really interesting to me. I mean, nature is so, so resilient, right? And despite everything that we've done, you know, all the buildings and the concrete and the roads and the ditches and the dikes and the, you know, engineering, you know, the harbor system, everywhere you look, you know, you're bumping, especially when it comes to shorebirds, right? You know, we find egrets and skimmers and heron. Just today we saw two huge blue heron when we're on the water this morning doing our water quality testing work. And, you know, it's incredible. Not far from the office here is Crab Bank, which is, you know, high tide, mostly disappeared, but it, you know, tends to be typically full of pelicans anytime there's sand there. I think, you know, pelicans are probably some of my favorite birds. They're just incredible to watch, especially out over the ocean when there's a little bit of swell running. They'll actually use the uplift of the air off the face of the wave to kind of glide along. But when you get into the water, I mean, you know, dolphin, we have an occasional manatee up this way, which is always really interesting. You know, we see alligator every once in a while come down the Ashley. Saw one in Hobcock Creek not too long ago. Of course, we've got redfish, sheep's head. I mean, you name it, a flounder. We've got a pretty strong flounder fish, a pretty strong flounder fishery that's struggling a little bit with you know, with some issues related to climate change and some other things. But we're lucky to have some pretty strong inshore fisheries, recreational, of course, shrimp and oysters and you and me, human beings.
So how can these species inform us as to the health of this system?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And a lot of times we look at that part of this issue or that part of the work that we do through the lens of the oyster. You know, the oyster, the lowly oyster, right? Like it grows in place and it can't move and it can't go anywhere. And it sits there and, you know, filters water all day long. And, you know, and it is a really remarkable thing. But I think even more so, the oyster enjoys the state's highest and best water quality protections. Right. So our most strict and protective water quality standards all revolve around the oyster, which I think is really neat. So if we do what's right for the oyster, we'll do right by all the birds, all the fish, all the marine mammals. And, you know, we'll have a healthy functioning system. The day that you can safely eat an oyster out of the Charleston Harbor, you know, we finally made it. Right. And nobody should be eating oysters that grow in the Charleston Harbor right now. So there's your disclaimer. But there are lots of oysters growing, in the outer areas of our estuary that are plenty safe to eat. And I enjoy those a lot and frequently, especially in season. So
you mentioned humans as being part of this system. What do human communities look like in this watershed?
So we're real fortunate here that I think, you know, everybody has some basic understanding and connection to the surrounding estuary. I talk to a lot of waterkeepers all over the country and really all over the world. And, you know, one of the things waterkeepers and other communities really struggle with is to reintroduce their community to the local river, to the local harbor, or whatever it is. Oftentimes, you know, especially in more industrialized areas or in other parts of the world, the local river is so dirty and so polluted that people don't use it. They don't even fish it. They don't, you know, they don't go for a paddle. They don't go near it. You know, it stinks. It's unhealthy. It's not a place that you want to be. And, you know, we haven't had that problem so much here. We do in certain areas. We do in certain areas. And, you know, we can talk about that issue too, because, you know, depending on what you look like, you know, the impacts that you experience in your waterways here in Charleston are very different. And so, you know, the advantage that we have here in Charleston is, you know, to a T, you know, people are aware of the surrounding estuary and they're aware of, you know, and they're aware of it and have some basic connection to it. And so I think that's, you know, that's really important. And so, you know, as Charleston Waterkeeper, our job has been to like deepen and strengthen that connection for folks and talk about why it's important and what it means to the community. I mean, how many people do you know that fish, that boat, that paddle, that swim, that surf, even people, you know, that are bird watchers, they're some of the most avid conservationists out there because they really enjoy, you know, watching a pelican soar over the harbor or, you know, spotting black skimmers or, you know, anything like that. And so, you know, we're fortunate to have that here. And so, you know, that's not everybody. Charleston's community is changing like daily. I mean, I don't know what we get, like 50 new people every day or something like that. And they're coming from areas that aren't necessarily like this, right? They're coming from New York, they're coming from Ohio, they're coming from, you know, inland in the Southeast, and maybe don't have an understanding of what this is and why it's so special. And so, you know, that's another reason why we feel like it's really important to, you know, to be able to help folks build that connection and understand what this is that surrounds us and why it's so important.
So let's go a little bit further. You brought up the idea of how the relationship with the water is not necessarily equitable. It's not necessarily an even experience for all of the communities around here. How has access to the water changed over time? And how has the quality of the water that could be accessed changed over time?
Right. If you stand down at White Point Gardens, you look out over the harbor, you know, everything's, you know, really, really pretty and, you know, it looks nice. And it's a totally different experience if you move, you know, up the Cooper River and you're right there under the Don Holt and you're at Hendricks Park in North Charleston. And there's a giant stinky paper mill that is, you know, spewing discolored water out of its discharge. And people fish and they crab there regularly. Right. But, you know, for a lot of folks, that's out of sight and out of mind. Right. But to the folks in that community, I mean, that, you know, that's access impeded, right? It's access restricted by, you know, I can't go fish there, you know, when I can't breathe the air, or I can't go fish there and I can't crab there and take those fish home and feel like I can safely eat them without them being contaminated. You know, that's a loss of access. That's a taking away of that right to clean water for fishing and swimming that's, you know, guaranteed, you know, under this notion of the public trust, but also under the Federal Clean Water Act, you know, that all water should be fishable and swimmable for everybody. And so, you know, depending, you know, if you live, if you live in the neck area, if you live in parts of North Charleston, you know, you experience some really degraded and impacted tidal creek systems, right, that, you know, aren't healthy, that are just hanging on, that, you know, aren't functioning the way they should be, but that are still remarkably resilient and I think are just waiting for us to invest in them. You know, and I'm hoping to see more and more of that from the city of North Charleston. I think there's some exciting opportunities coming down the pipeline where we can connect things like transportation issues and food desert issues and access to water issues and access to clean creeks and rivers issues. And we can kind of connect those all together and, you know, kind of make a really resilient and sustainable community through, you know, from the peninsula all the way up, as far as we can go.
What kind of ecosystem functions are afforded by a healthy salt marsh ecosystem or by a healthy river system ecosystem?
Oh gosh. So think about what we have here in this, you know, we have an estuary, right, that has, you know, at its, you know, headwaters, a bunch of freshwater wetlands, right? And so, nature has designed this system through eons of hydrologic process to flood and unflood and filter water. And, you know, it's absolutely remarkable. It's like the perfect system. It's like land and water in balance working together, right? And now what we've done is come along and throughout history have just completely altered that balance, right? Changed the way that the land and the water work together. And so, you know, in its, you know, pristine state, you know, it should be offering, you know, healthy fish to eat. It should be offering healthy oysters and, you know, a complete and fully functioning populations of, I mean, you name the wildlife species, but, of course, protections from floods and all that sort of thing. And so, it can still do that. I mean, we are smart enough to take a look at the built environment and re-engineer it, right, to mimic that natural relationship or to better set that balance. You know, when you build a new neighborhood, you take out all the native soils, flatten and compact everything down, direct all the, you know, stormwater into a pond, and there's so many better ways to do that. Right. And it starts with protecting the freshwater wetland and it starts with protecting native soils. Those two things are designed to really work together to hold that floodwater and let it filter out into the nearest creek or river slowly over time while removing pollutants. And so, you know, it's you can't upset the balance. It's such a delicate system and it's such a balanced system that if you interrupt one part of that process, you know, to say we care about the Ashley River, you know, we need to say we care about development that's happening, you know, 30 miles away, right? And a lot of people don't think about the Ashley River, but it goes almost all the way up to the lakes in the Cypress and Wasabasaw swamps. And so when you get up there and you start altering the balance in those freshwater wetlands, you're impacting what's happening downstream in the Ashley River. And so, you know, thinking about these things holistically and thinking about these things on a, you know, on a ecoregion scale or, you know, not just an ecoregion scale, but I mean, thinking about it holistically and comprehensively about what happens to the Ashley River when you affect one part of the system, I think is absolutely critical, absolutely critical. And so, you know, our rivers, creeks, harbor, our estuary is what sustains us here, but it's also going to be, right, it's also going to be what impacts us. And so, you know, we need to, it's up to us, you know, the days of just saying, passively setting it aside and saying, oh, we're protecting this and that's enough, I think are over. You know, we have to, really what we're in the business of right now is managing consequences of past decisions. And so, you know, we've got to get real serious about ways to reset that balance. And it, you know, it all starts with protecting the quality of the water. If you protect the quality of the water, if that's your goal, you're looking at doing the things that will protect the oysters, will protect the fish, will protect us from flooding, will protect our investments in property and our livelihoods and our commutes to work and all of those things. It all starts with water quality.
So there are a few different directions I'd love to go with that.
That was great.
First of all, I think the idea of watersheds is a really complex form of systems thinking that most people aren't necessarily engaged with. You mentioned that for the Ashley River, you have to be thinking about potentially 30 miles away or 30 miles upstream. Let's use that as an example. What forms the Ashley River and how can it be impacted by the land and various tributaries around it?
Right. So, the Ashley River is a tidal slough, right? And so it doesn't have a connection to a freshwater inland river system. Okay. And the Cooper River, you know, should be the same thing as well, but, you know, we've engineered a connection, you know, through hubris and a lot of other things, and, you know, the need to bring electricity to rural areas and that sort of stuff. But the bottom line is, you know, these systems should arise out of these freshwater swamps, right? And so, you know, those swamps and those wetlands are wet some of the time and dry some of the time. And, you know, if you drive around, you know, the Cypress and Wassamasaw swamps, you know, up above Somerville and St. Stephen and that whole area, if you drive around up there, it's really surprising. Or even if you go like between the Edisto River, getting a little further south, and the Ashley River, you know, where they're doing a lot of building and Somerville's expanding that way, you know, you look at the land and it's not really land, right? It's essentially dry wetland sometimes. And so, you know, when it rains, it fills up and holds that water and all that. And so, you know, when we alter that up there, we are sending more, and you're not only sending more water, but you're sending it at a faster rate into the main stem of the Ashley River. And that's, you know, the river wasn't designed to handle that, right? Nature didn't design it to handle a huge slug of fresh water over a short period of time. It designed it to handle, and really remarkably so, a slow influx of fresh water from those wetlands. And so, you know, what are you impacting, right? When you fill in a wetland, you know, and build, you know, whatever it is, a new industrial park or a new housing development, when you filled that wetland in up there, right, you've now altered the salinity in parts of the Ashley River and possibly flooded out people, you know, downstream that have lived there with higher water levels. And, you know, there are regulations in place that are designed to, you know, mitigate that and prevent that. But, you know, as a whole, you know, they don't look at the cumulative impact of those projects. You know, as a developer, you just have to prove at the point of discharge that, you know, through some, you know, math modeling that, you know, you won't increase the, you know, pre-development rate of discharge. And so, you know, that's fine. But what about when you start, that only accounts, you know, there's all kinds of weird numbers games that get played in there too, right? It doesn't account for, it accounts for peak flow, but not for volume, right? So your volume can be higher, but your peak flow has to be the same. So which means you can stretch that out over a period of time, but, you know, as long as you don't exceed that peak flow, which, you know, is really interesting to me. I think, you know, we need a better set of regulations and a better set of laws that look at these things as natural systems, not just as mathematical models and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, you can't you know, you, like I said, you know, you can't upset one set of the system without having an impact somewhere else. And I think those, the type of systems thinking that I think is important is to understand that piece, right? Like, you know, we're doing this here, right? And, but what about the next one that comes along the line or the next one? There is no unifying vision, you know, under the regulations for how these projects might work together. They're only analyzed in silos. And so breaking down those silos and looking at the cumulative impact of these projects, I think is absolutely critical. I don't know that, you know, had we started doing that, you know, during Charleston's, you know, first boom, or, you know, during the 60s and 70s, you know, and then, you know, kept up with kind of a broader vision for how those cumulative impacts might play out in our waterways, we might be, I think we would flood less, we'd have healthier fish, we'd have healthier dolphins, and we'd have much healthier waterways overall.
So let's keep going with that for a second. How can regulatory bodies or policy be shifted to or updated in a way that is more systems based, or a way that is better prepared to deal with the increasing challenges that a coastal city like Charleston will face?
That's a great question, and one I might not be able to answer, because we don't even get there a lot of the times in South Carolina, right? The way, you know, in our system of government here in the United States, you know, federal law usually sets the floor, and then it's up to states to meet that floor or choose to go higher. And so when it comes to environmental protection in South Carolina, we get the minimum level of protection prescribed by federal law. And so, you know, we're really not talking about, we're arguing over how to meet the floor, right? And, you know, when what we really need to be doing is thinking about how we can go further. And that starts in the General Assembly, right? Our elected state representatives and our elected state senators that work for us need to get serious about using the power of regulation and using the power of the law to support just that. Right. But that's never been a popular proposition here. Right. You know, South Carolina luckily has a long tradition of conservation minded work, which is great. I mean, it's really great. But, you know, we haven't yet learned to rely on, you know, regulations and, you know, a legal framework to be able to do that. A lot of the conservation here has happened through, you know, conservation easement and purchase and set aside of, you know, big tracts of land. And that's all really great work. I think, you know, part of the problem with some of that though, is it kind of ignores or kind of gives up on the sort of inner core. Right. We're preserving land and all around us, which is really important work, but yet we're maybe ignoring or underinvesting in areas where folks are already fishing and crabbing and using the water. Like it's nice to have a bunch of preserved land up in Francis Marion, but most people most people aren't up there and enjoying it. You know, they're in and around the peninsula. They're in Noisette Creek. They're in Philbin Creek. They're, you know, over at Northbridge Park on the Ashley River, you know, places like that. And so, you know, I think to the extent that we can look at ways, you know, that we can explore policy solutions that kind of reinvest in some of those areas. And I think that's where you need, you know, you can't do a conservation easement in a public park, it already exists, but, you know, we have a pretty, you know, we have a basic framework of law and regulation that protects water quality for the people using that. And so I think some stronger support, one for the existing stuff that's already on the books, but, you know, also, you know, expanding that to have better enforcement about, you know, to have stronger permits that look at resiliency and climate change, to have permits that get enforced in meaningful ways. Oh gosh, I mean, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot that can be done here. But you know, it Gray, I think, you know, there's a lot of room for improvement, and I don't know that any state does this super well, right? You know, it kind of gets lost in the politics. And I think that's one of the things that Charleston Waterkeeper does, and a lot of the other conservation organizations, you know, friends at the Coastal Conservation League and you know, Conservation Voters of SC, you know, this idea of us as conservation organizations providing a pathway to connect citizens to their local elected leaders. I think it's such an important role for us to play. In a way, it's making democracy work, right? It's connecting people to the issues that are impacting the health of their waterways and then connecting them to the leaders that have been elected to make the tough choices to fix those problems, I think is just super critical. And anytime we can do that on a water quality issue that's important to our waterways here in the Charleston area, we really engage and do our best to be active and on those issues. So that was a bit of a wide ranging answer, I think, to a good question.
So let's talk about those engaged citizens, those folks who are out there using these creeks, using these waterways. What can they be doing if, for whatever reason, policy or politicians aren't able to go as far as they need to ensure healthy waterways, waterways that are working correctly for them? What can the ordinary citizen do?
So, right. I just heard this phrase, like, the best action is action. Right. It's about being active. And like, if you see something, say something. Right. And, you know, because we don't have the strongest and most robust set of regulations that, you know, protect our waterways and protect our communities, it's up to us to stand up and make the change that we want to happen. And so, you know, a lot of times people will call us or email us with an issue. I mean, for example, the nurdle issue and the plastic pellets in our waterways was reported to us by a gentleman that walks on Sullivan's Island every morning, right? And so, you know, that issue, you know, we became aware of from a report from the public. And so we then, you know, we get the environmental protection that we advocate for. And so we got involved in that issue. We, you know, worked it, documented the problem. You know, we used the Federal Clean Water Act and the Resource Conservation Recovery Act to hold the polluter in that case accountable. But we also, have worked with our friends at Coastal Conservation League to be able to find a policy solution and make sure that those pellets and those, you know, potential for spills is regulated under DHEC's authority to manage and control stormwater discharges from industrial facilities. And so, you know, that is the way a lot of this happens in this state, right? It would be nice if we could all just kind of get together on some good policies and implement them. And, you know, you would have strong and active state agencies that were really looking out for the best interest of their communities and their constituencies, you know, that are using the water, but that's not the way it happens, right? So, you know, what I encourage folks to do is if you see something, say something, let us know about it, you know, call us, email us, you know, I mean, even, you know, tweet at us or tag us on social or whatever, you know, and we can try to get to the bottom of it. I think that's one of the bread and butter services that waterkeepers provide to their community, right? Is the ability to investigate pollution and then hold polluters accountable. We're a small organization, and you know, we're only three people, but we get after some big issues. And so, you know, it's really important for folks to help us, you know, help us be the eyes and ears. You know, I've only got two ears and two eyes. So, it's helpful when folks report those issues to us, and then, you know, we can go after them in a really dogged way and make sure that we get a resolution that's beneficial for our community and for our waterways.
So with that in mind, it seems like citizen science is a key factor in all of this. Who are your creek watchers? I saw you have an organization called the Creek Watcher Program. Who are these avid defenders of their local waterways?
Oh man, I think we're all at Waterkeeper here, Charleston Waterkeeper. We're all geeks for citizen science. Our creek watchers are a group of trained citizen scientists or citizen stewards that go out to different places every month and sample water quality and then report the data back to us. And so what they are kind of our network of eyes and ears out in the community. And what's been really neat is over time, folks that use and, you know, paddle or fish or crab at the areas where our creek watchers are testing and making observations have come to know Charleston Waterkeeper through the Creek Watcher that's working at their site. And so, you know, the Creek Watchers in that way have become, you know, their own advocates and ambassadors for clean water, which I think is really great. I mean, that's about getting out, meeting people where they are, you know, and showing them why and how we do what we do and why it's important and how that data feeds back up to the organization, and even to DHEC and to our state agencies so that they can use that data to identify problems. But so long story short is, we've cultivated a network of volunteers, citizen scientists that we train up to do water quality testing. So they sample for dissolved oxygen, temperature, salinity, pH, and clarity. And they also do dolphin surveys and do plastic pellet surveys for us. They identify invasive species and invasive species of algae and some other things. And so they are that kind of early warning network, right? So, you know, when we send something in the data or they observe something that isn't right, you know, we're able to investigate further and take the appropriate actions or notify the appropriate authorities. And so, you know, we've got it's dang near 30 sites now, plus the 20 that we do every week for bacteria during the warmer months in the summer. So, you know, we have a network of, you know, probably what some of the Creek Watcher sites and the bacteria sites overlap, but I bet we've got a network of maybe 40 different sites where we're monitoring regularly, you know, the health and the quality of your water, whether it's by us as staff members or whether it's by our citizen science Creek Watchers. I can't tell you how cool those people are. They give their time and energy, and you know, we've got a few husband and wife teams. We've got individuals, we've got families, we've got it's just a great group of folks to do that. I would dearly love to have multiple Creek Watchers on every creek in the community from here all the way through the Tri-County area. And, you know, it's really become a question for us. You know, it's not just a question of money to buy new kits. Like, we need more people. We need more staff members in-house to manage and grow and train and coordinate all those volunteers. You know, that right now falls to Cheryl Carmack, who does an absolutely fantastic job at it. But, you know, she's only one person. I need to have like four or five of her to really meet the need out there for that kind of work in our community. But that Creek Watcher program has been really awesome and fun to see those. And, you know, it's brought back important data to us that we're able to pass on to our state agencies and decision makers, but it's brought important data for us to serve as that early warning and monitoring network about the health of your waterways.
So what are some of the things that you've been finding from that data?
Right. Well, you know, that's a good question, right? And so a lot of our waterways will go almost fresh after a big rainstorm, right? So think about that. Like a tidal creek, you know, should always be fairly brackish and have a pretty, you know, a pretty good level of salinity. But after a rainstorm, like a Shem Creek or a James Island Creek might be totally fresh, right? A Philbin Creek, right? We've been seeing real high levels of bacteria in Philbin Creek at Hendricks Park up there in North Charleston. And, you know, some real low salinity levels after rainstorms. And so that's allowing the bacteria to survive where the salt water should kill it pretty quickly. High levels of flood and stormwater, fresh water, and low levels of salinity in the creek allow the bacteria to persist and potentially expose people to harmful levels of contamination from bacteria. You know, so that's an important issue that's become, you know, that relationship, you know, has really been borne out in the data. The other thing too is, you know, we're discovering, you know, other potential sources of plastic pellet pollution, right? You know, there are different pathways for that to end up in the water. And so really trying to get a handle on that and understand exactly where that's coming from is really important. So, you know, we want to make sure that we track down all the different sources of that here in our watershed and make sure that they're held accountable for containing those things. We shouldn't be finding any of them, but we frequently find them in places we shouldn't. The program's been really good for that, right? You know, and looking at that, we need Charleston Waterkeeper, you know, and how we've always struggled with how to communicate that data back to the public. You know, that that's that's always been a challenge. And so, you know, we're looking for ways to better communicate it back to the public about what that data is doing and what it means and what it says about the healthier waterways. It's easy to get too technical and too sciencey and just bore people. It's, you know, it's more fun when you can tell a good story with it, and it's more engaging for folks, and I think it's more meaningful. So hopefully you'll see in the next, let's say 9 months to 18 months, you know, some better storytelling from us around what that data is saying.
So just kind of putting together all the different impacts that we've talked about so far, we've seen intense development pressures disrupting the way the hydrology is able to impact the water systems. We're seeing industrial impacts. We're seeing potentially commercial from shipping. What are some other areas that you guys are looking at in particular?
So, you know, I've been thinking a lot lately about the issue of climate change, right? And, you know, and the way we talk about it, I think it isn't working here locally. I think, you know, climate change is the thread that connects all this together, right? And it, you know, its impact, like, well, let me put it this way. It's not that climate is changing. The climate has changed. And it's not good for your waterways, right? I think that's the way we need to be talking about it. And so, you know, everything from, you know, sex bias in the population of flounder, so the population can't grow and regenerate itself like it normally would, to, you know, stress on the root systems of the grass in the marsh, right? And the thinning and bearing of the marsh, to erosion of tidal creeks, to oyster beds that get wiped out because they're no longer in the right tidal range, to, you know, higher levels of bacteria from storm and floodwater, to, you know, an industrial facility that can't handle, you know, flood and rainwater. And, you know, one time it's plastic pellets, another time it's, you know, another time it's, you know, dioxane or other chemicals that, you know, get washed into the water, and, you know, treatment plants that are, you know, industrial wastewater treatment plants that are literally on the banks of the Cooper River with eroding shoreline around them. I mean, those are resiliency issues, you know, made worse by climate change, and how those facilities handle floodwater that gets into their treatment systems. And, you know, the issue of climate change, I mean, everything from like making the oyster shells thinner because the water is more acidic and they can't calcify as strong as they used to a sewage treatment plant that struggles with an influx of floodwater and everything in between. Climate change is impacting, affecting it, making it worse, making it more difficult. And at the losing end of that are your rivers and creeks, right? They are the thing that connects us all and the thing that bears the brunt of all those impacts. And so, when we talk about climate change, you know, we talk about, oh, the city floods more times than it used to, or, you know, we need a big seawall, right? I think we're missing the point a little bit. Those things are important. I don't mean to minimize them. They're important, but I think we're missing or overlooking the way it connects all these issues that are degrading the health of our waterways. And if we start to focus on those in different ways, I think it'll make the decisions about how we protect the historic fabric of our city to how we invest in communities that haven't seen. I mean, if you look at the drainage issue, parts of the peninsula get a lot of investment in drainage infrastructure and parts of North Charleston don't, parts of the neck don't, right? So that means those communities are being exposed to contaminated floodwater more frequently than folks in other, you know, in communities with better levels of investment. And so it's a public health issue, it's a water quality issue, it's a climate change issue, and all those things are kind of intersecting, you know, and it's climate change makes everything worse is the best way I can describe it. And so, you know, it's making already challenging issues more difficult. But I think if we start looking at the issue through the lens of our waterways, it'll make the solutions clearer, right? And it'll also show us where we should be investing by who's bearing the most brunt of these issues, right? And so, you know, I think we need to start looking at it not from the land and saying the water is the problem coming up, right? We need to start looking at it from the water and saying, you know, what can we do to make sure that this stays healthy and this stays clean and that it's not contaminated for the people that live on land? And so, or, I mean, geez, like I've, you know, just glossed over, you know, it's not contaminated and exposing us to contamination, but it's also not impacting the health of the dolphin, the flounder, the oyster, the shrimp, you know, the healthy population of redfish. You know, we've got to look at it through that lens. We've got to look at it through that lens moving forward. You know, and you know, with the new intergovernmental report on climate change that just came out earlier this week, you know, the red flag is up, right? The red flag is up. And, you know, the best thing, you know, the best action is action, right? We have got to act. You know, it's no longer an issue of staving it off. It's an issue of dealing with the consequences. And the way you deal with the consequences is by looking at, you know, the least common denominator among us, which is the health of our waterways. And if we can interpret the solutions through that lens, we will be better off 100 years from now. And not even 100 years from now, 30 years from now, you know, when the next generation of leadership is taking on the conservation issues, you know, hopefully they'll look back and say, well, that was the right lens to look at this. I hope they're not having the same argument that we're, or the same discussion that we're having right now. That would mean we haven't done enough.
I completely agree with that sentiment. And I've had similar conversations with Laura Cantrell of the Coastal Conservation League and Rick Crawford of Sustainable Angler and Merger Studios and or Merger Strategies. And one key point that both of them have made that I think is part of what you were just saying too is that our salt marshes, which are this kind of driving engine of this coastal system, are going to have to move. What are we doing right now for that?
Right. Well, yeah, I think we've got a twofold issue there, right? I think, you know, the salt marsh isn't able to migrate or struggles to migrate now because of the built environment. You know, I'm sure you heard this from both Rick and Laura, who, you know, have a high degree of respect for both. And, you know, they are spot on to point to the salt marsh. The thing that I worry about is, you know, when I look at a lot of salt marsh and I, you know, it weighs on me heavy. It does not look healthy. It looks thin. It looks bare. There's big dead spots in the middle of it. You know, what should be stands of grass that are, you know, chest high are now like, you know, thigh high. And, you know, they should be thick and lush and deep, you know, and a deep, dark kind of green right now. And they aren't, you know, they look kind of yellow and a little brown prematurely. And I think we are seeing the beginnings of a salt marsh that's starting to stress, that is really starting to stress and is in danger of collapse. And so it's not only providing corridors for that to migrate. I mean, that's a big part of this, right? You know, I think the problem is, you know, the stress of sea level rise and the marsh being underwater for longer periods of time has made the marsh susceptible to other, you know, diseases and other threats that are impacting its health. But, you know, we need to look at, you know, we need to look at how we can allow that marsh to migrate further upstream, what areas need to be protected, you know, what areas need to be restored. But we also need to be looking at the health of what's already here and what we can do to protect that, right? And that's a tough issue. I mean, I would dearly love to see, you know, the marsh, you know, it's going to go further. Salt marsh is going to work its way further and further up the Cooper River, further and further up the Ashley River, you know, over time. And you know, we have a lot of protected land around the Ashley River, which I think is really going to be helpful for that. So that's great. But, you know, I worry about areas where, you know, you've got houses and roads let me point to you this way. If you've ever driven south out of Charleston on 17, you cut right through a lot of salt marsh. And if you look on the left side, so you're going south out of Charleston, you're looking out towards the water and, you know, out towards the ocean, you'll see old dead sort of ghost live oak trees, right? And those trees have died because their root systems have been exposed to salt water, right? And so what happens is you have a road or a causeway that cuts through the marsh, doesn't allow, you know, the marsh to migrate and move around, and it just ends up getting deeper and deeper and deeper on the one side. And I think that's the condition that we'll start seeing more and more frequently around the more urban and built-in areas as those marsh and can't migrate and move inland. You know, we're going to see a lot of dead and dying, you know, vegetation and flora that we've seen, you know, for millennia here. We've got to figure out a way to let that marsh migrate, you know, and hopefully, you know, what I would expect to see is as it migrates, it gets healthier and healthier. But I worry about what's here right now. You know, I see a lot of unhealthy looking salt marsh.
What does a failing or collapsed salt marsh mean for this system?
Oh gosh. The salt marsh and the oyster bed and the tidal creek are the three key fundamental pieces of the estuary. Right. And so, you know, if you lose one of those, think about, you know, you just essentially have dry, bare mudflats that have no place for birds to hide, that have no place to, you know, serve as nursery habitat for, you know, redfish or crab or blue crab. I mean, it could mean the collapse of the entire system. Right. I mean, that's what's at stake. And so, it would be, oh, I don't have a good analogy, but you know, you can't lose, you know, it's the classic three-legged stool analogy, right? You can't lose one of those legs without losing the whole thing. And so, you know, if you lose the oyster bed, I think that's another critical habitat, right? And you see a lot of unhealthy looking oyster bed around the harbor, as well. And you see a lot of tidal creek that's eroding, you know, partially from boat wake and that kind of thing. But also from sea level rise, you know, as the water gets further and further into the marsh and inundates it for longer periods of time, that just, you know, wreaks havoc on the hydrology of those systems. So, we've got to get these issues right moving forward. Right. The best action is action.
And speaking of action, you guys are already working with the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources to take some action in those areas with local people. How can individuals become more involved in the oyster planting and grass planting efforts that you guys are doing?
Oh, I would love for folks just to go to Charleston Waterkeeper. .org/volunteer. And there's an ever-changing list of volunteer opportunities that are published there. And so if you want to do an oyster build and you don't see one, just wait, one will be there. If you want to do a marsh planting, just wait, one will be there. But there's always something going on. And it can be as simple as we've got a bunch of DIY cleanup kits. You can check out a cleanup kit and go and do a cleanup with your friends or family, or you can do one by yourself and do that. Or you can come to a big volunteer event where we're hauling bags of oyster shells or bagging up shells to be planted in the next season. Just on Monday, we helped DNR clean out our Spartina greenhouses so that they could be ready for the next growing season. So there's always something going on there. And it's about getting involved, but not only getting involved, it's about taking that experience and talking to your state legislators, right? Hey, I did this with Charleston Waterkeeper. This is important to me. I vote, I pay attention to conservation issues, and I want you to take action. And I want you to be in tune to those issues. And I want you to be in tune to things that we can do to locally to combat climate change. It's the little things on a local scale and local political action that I think is really going to drive this issue up, right? Up and towards the kind of change that we need. And we have to get involved. You have to get your hands dirty. You have to get active on the local level in order to make progress on this issue. And I think it starts with being frank about what we're seeing in terms of impacts from an issue like climate change, right? You know, it's not some big esoteric thing. It's not wildfires in California, right? It's dying salt marsh here in your community. It's not being able to catch a flounder with your daughter. Right. It's those little issues, right, that, you know, spark the awareness and then also turn folks into stewards and advocates for clean water that are going to drive change on this issue. And so, you know, everybody's got to get involved. Everybody's got to get in. Everybody's got to get their hands dirty with this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a global grassroots effort is how I like to describe it.
I like that. I might borrow that.
Please do. I love to ask everybody this question, because I think we cover a lot of serious things in the show, because a lot of things going on in the world that really require our attention are you know, big challenges. But I'm always curious to know what gives you hope.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, it's the resiliency of nature is amazing, right? I mean, every time you give it a little chance, right? Just give it a little crack, right? It'll fill that crack. And I mean, just through the remarkable processes of nature, will bloom again. And in some ways, you know, that gives me hope. But you know, it's incumbent upon us to, you know, to make sure that those cracks are there and to try to pry them open as wide as possible. But you know, that resiliency, I think, is really interesting to me, sort of on a nature scale. But you know, more than that, like, my daughter will be starting college this year, and she, you know, the kids are so much more aware of these issues, right? And than I ever was at her age. And I mean, it's been part of, you know, environmental issues. Well, I guess partly because of what her dad does for a living, but partly, you know, because they're just part of the conversation now with kids. And you know, it's really interesting to see. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, I was a product of kind of that first environmental awakening, but you know, this stuff is ingrained now, right? It is ingrained now. And the other thing that I think is encouraging, and this may sound a little negative, but you know, the kids sometimes don't have a high degree of respect for, you know, what we've been able to accomplish, which I think is a great thing, right? They're going, you know what, you know, they're not doing it right. They're not doing it good enough, and we can do it better, right? And I love that attitude, right? That attitude, I think, is really important, because it's an action-oriented attitude. You know, there'll be ups and downs along the way, but I, you know, if Waterkeeper can play a role, I mean, we've had an active intern program for a long time, and I love to get the interns in here and get them empowered, right? And then you kind of teach them as much as you can, and you send them off, and they're going off and doing really cool stuff. You know, one doing fisheries research in Alaska, another one was at Woods Hole. It's neat to see these kids go on. We had one that went on and is actually working with a Waterkeeper organization in Washington State. We've had one go on and become a Waterkeeper, which is really awesome. But it's that kind of action-oriented thing I see in the younger generation, that I think is really cool. I think it's cool. And I hope we don't stifle that. I hope we encourage it, and I hope we try to support it.
Well, that's awesome. I think that is a wonderful message to close things out on. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Great. This was really great. Always enjoy talking, and, thank you.
If you're interested in learning more about Andrew Wunderly and the Charleston Waterkeeper, please check out our show notes on enduringcuriosity.org. Curiosity is the greatest gift from our childhood. Thank you for joining us so far through this first season. Please join us again this fall as we return from the field with fascinating new conversations with thought leaders, innovators, and storytellers working to transform our world. Until then, I'm your host, Greg Outer. See you next time.